As you may have seen, the Acting Minister of Energy and Resources has issued a press release welcoming the approach being taken by the Pike River receivers to seek a commitment from any purchaser to take all reasonable steps to recover the miners' bodies. In May, the receivers publicly said that they would seek a commitment from any purchaser to take all reasonable steps to recover the miners' bodies. We support this approach and made clear the government's expectation that parties will continue to explore all options to recover the bodies. We understand potential purchasers have acknowledged this in their indicative bids, and that any purchaser would commit under the sale and purchase agreement to using their best endeavours to recover the bodies. The government welcomes the receiver's clear expectations that any purchaser would commit to recover the bodies of the miners, provided it is reasonably possible to do so, and subject always to safety considerations. As such, the government would expect to see any agreement to transfer the mining permit to be subject to a suitable commitment from the purchaser. The challenges faced at the mine are complex, but I fully understand the desire of the families of those who died to have the bodies recovered. We are proceeding in a way that offers the best chance of recovering the miners' bodies and restoring to the West Coast a working mine if it is possible to do so. Turning to other matters, this afternoon my office issued a statement announcing the reappointment of Professor Sir Peter Gluckman as my Chief Science Advisor for another 2 years. Sir Peter has been extremely effective Chief Science Advisor since he was appointed in the newly created role in 2009. When I created the role, it's my intention that science be put at the heart of the government and our decision making, and Sir Peter has fulfilled the purposes of the role very well. Just in terms of India, on Friday I returned from a very successful 5-day state visit to India. Finalising a free trade deal with India was always going to be a complex process, but this visit has left me more confident than ever that we are making good progress on concluding the FTA scheduled for early next year. While we were in New Delhi, Prime Minister Singh and I announced initiatives on film co-production, education, science and defence. As you're aware, because we took an Air Force Boeing 757, we were able to take with us a business delegation of CEOs who pursued their own business agenda. This was invaluable in terms of relationship and profile building, and there are high hopes that this will translate into valuable trade. Tomorrow I'm attending a state dinner for the King of Tonga. On Wednesday I'm speaking to the Wellington Employers Chamber of Commerce and speaking at the launch of the National Community Program to support water safety in New Zealand. On Thursday I have a number of events in Hamilton, and on Friday I'll be in Auckland. When the House resumes tomorrow, the government intends to make further progress on the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service Amendment Bill, the Courts and Criminal Matters Bill, and other bills on the order paper. Wednesday the 6th of July is scheduled to be a Member's Day.
Prime Minister, with regard to the Pike River matter, has the government given any further consideration, just the comments you made about the families needing some surety, about reconsidering actually stuffing up cash and paying for the recovery operation itself?
Well, as I've always said, if a credible plan was put to the government, one that ensured the safety of those that would undertake the recovery, the government would consider that. But at this point, what we are discussing is a sale and purchase agreement headed by the receivers and what the government's expectations would be in meeting that sale and purchase agreement.
Can I just clarify, are you saying that the transfer of the mining permit will be contingent on a recovery plan and commitment?
Well, that's our expectations, that providing it can be done the way that it's safe, and providing it's credible, then we have a very strong desire to see any future purchaser of the mine actively undertaking a recovery of the remains and of the bodies, and as such that's one of the conditions that we would be expecting to be met.
So if they came up with a package that didn't include that, you would kick it back even if it was potentially economically viable
otherwise? Well, that's likely to be the case. There are always conditions that might not meet that, but that would mainly be if it wasn't safe or credible to actually get into the mine.
So the purchaser may well discuss and negotiate with the government about what proportion of recovery cap and cost you would be prepared to
meet? They could do, but I think in the first instance our expectation is that any purchaser would put in their bid to the receiver, as has, we understand, the case from indicative bids from the receiver. Some of those bids have included a clear plan to recover the bodies as part of a reopening of the mine, and that is the government's preferred position.
Because that press release from the contract receiver says that they can't actually, they can't make someone that buys the mine recover the bodies.
That's
so
right.
If they were to not include that.
Yep. That's right. The receivers. The receivers can't necessarily guarantee that, but the government has to approve a transfer of the mining permit, and it's at that point that the conditions can be attached.
Well, the government can guarantee that. Why can't you just legislate for it?
Because, as I say, it has to meet certain conditions, which include safety, have to be credible. There are a number of factors to be considered, but the government's making it very clear to New Zealanders today that if somebody comes in and purchases the mine, it's the government's expectations as we sign off the transfer of that mining permit that a full attempt will be made to recover the remains of the loved ones that were lost in the Pike River mine.
So does that mean that the enforcement of the recovery of the body transfers to MD and away from
the police? No, the operational responsibility is always one of the police, as I understand it, but this is the issue of who has responsibility for the transfer of the mining permit and under what conditions have to be met. That's a matter for MED and the Minister of Energy and Resources.
When you talk about whether recovery is credible or not, you mean would the cost of recovery be assessed within that?
I guess that's a factor, but it's really whether it's possible to get in the mine in a way that's safe, in a way that makes re-entry of the mine credible. That's one of the factors we consider.
Presumably, if you're going to buy a mine and make it operational,
then you would be able to get in there. Yeah, I mean, look. I mean, the government's position is one that we don't believe it would be acceptable either to the families or to the wider New Zealand population to have somebody credibly re-enter the mine with the purposes of taking coal out and not undertake a credible recovery of the remains of there. I mean, that's just not acceptable to the government. There are always wider issues about what the entry point in the mine is and all those very complex issues, but in principle, we're spelling out what our expectations are.
The recovery would need to take place before any mining, would presume?
That's far too early to tell. I mean, we just need to see a credible plan from somebody that's a purchaser of the mine.
Can we ask you about whether you've had any advice about what could have been friendly fire, whether or not there was friendly fire in Afghanistan if it was OEC?
Yeah, so look, I've had a further update from the CDF today. The position is as they put it in their statement, that while it's a complex operation that took place at the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul, and while there are a number of agencies involved, that's not the belief of the New Zealand Defence Force that the injured soldier was injured as a result of friendly fire. It's always possible, but that's not the likely source.
If you an apology, is there an
official? There has been no official apology received.
What does the
CSA
talk about the Afghani troops that were joining? Are they up to it?
Yeah, in our view, yes, they've come an awfully long way. I mean, I think the Crisis Response Unit, in terms of the forces that are available to the Afghan government, they are the best. They're not as good as New Zealand SAS, but New Zealand SAS are world-class, as they proved once again last week. But they've certainly come a long way. But this was a very complex and difficult operation. It was it was well planned, and there were a number of interesting facets to it.
Did you ask the CDF if the SAS had actually been the reverse, that they had executed fired mistakenly on Afghani guests?
Well, that's not my understanding that's the case. I have a knowledge of the undertakings that they took. As we've said on numerous occasions, we talk about their involvement in specific operations, but we don't detail the actual actions that they take. But I've had no advice that that's been the case.
You said that it's not impossible that there could have been friendly fire. Is there any kind of investigation?
There's a review that takes place, and in due course we'll look at that.
Will they still be brought home in March?
That's my expectations. They will have been there for basically 2.5 years by then. As you're aware, they're a smaller unit now. I mean, their primary role is mentoring and partnering and enabling, as we saw. They played a very, very valuable role. It was a much smaller contingent that was there in the first instance when they had to call for backup. And so I think they're proving their worth. And as every day goes by, the crisis response unit is becoming more effective and more capable of handling these issues on their own.
Previously, you said that they've asked to stay on, and I suppose
we can't stop them making a request, but they will have been there for 2.5 years by then. They're fundamentally not a large unit, and my expectations and my sense at this point is they should come home and regroup.
Were they within their rules of engagement when they acted last week?
As I understand it.
Are you able to elaborate on what the rules of engagement are, given that primarily they're there to train and support the CRU?
Yeah, you need to take that up directly with the CDF, but it's not my understanding they've done anything outside the rules of engagement that were signed up.
Did they deal with gunshot wounds, or was it some other type of injury?
Combination.
What wounds? Do you mean a combination? What do you mean?
Well, some gunshot wounds and some other wounds.
What, like shrapnel?
Well, again, you might want to take that up to CDF, but it's a combination.
So is it possible you can't tell by the nature of those wounds where they were inflicted?
We can tell, but it's not for me to detail that. You need to take that up with CDF.
Were you disappointed you weren't told earlier about New Zealand's involvement before you gave the press conference, and India saying that New Zealand
was
involved?
Well, I didn't say they weren't involved. I said, to the best of the information I had at that time. Look, I think it's important to understand, I mean, at the point at which we held the press conference in India, it was 6 o'clock in the morning, Indian time. Actually, the major, the involvement actually of the New Zealanders as it escalated from being a mentoring exercise to an active combat happened actually after that press conference. As I said, in India, I mean, they go on a lot of missions. I'm simply not informed every time they go into a mentoring role. Otherwise, I'd be getting contacted a lot. But I have made it clear to the CDF and others that, look, you know, where something is in the public domain as that was, we just need to slightly tighten up our engagement in terms of communication.
Have you had any further thoughts on herbal highs and following the two drugs that have been taken off?
I'm not going to take them, if that's what you're asking. I'm not a guinea pig. I note this press release from Peter Dunn this afternoon and concur fully with his views, which is, you know, it's good that the industry is starting to look at how it can be more self-regulatory in nature. But the government's view is that we want to adopt the proposals as indicated by the Law Commission, and that is we want to change the burden of proof, if you like.
When do you think you can have that done?
I think it's within a few weeks, actually, Peter Dunn's indicating. I mean, there's obviously a lot of pressure on house time, but we're trying to get that done as quickly as we can.
When you talk to the employers on Wednesday, will you be talking about women's pay?
I don't think so, but we haven't written the speech yet.
Have you been briefed on Alex Fogarty and his involvement with the National Party, whether there was any knowledge of his links with an Australian white supremacy organisation?
No, the name doesn't ring a bell to me.
He was on the O'Hare Electorate Committee until earlier today.
It's eminently possible, but I just simply don't know. He's on every executive around, you know, 70 electorates around the country.
We've just had a big international cigarette tobacco maker say we'll sue the Australian government over law changes. I mean, what's the danger that this will happen to the New Zealand government under the trade agreement?
Well, my understanding is it's excluded. That risk is excluded in New Zealand because we specifically, when putting together our FTA, protected our rights in terms of public health in New Zealand.
In terms of anything?
Oh, well, as I said recently, we don't believe that there'll be frivolous claims taken. That's not our expectation. And when we negotiate FTAs, we look closely at those. And as I say, if that same case happened in New Zealand, the best advice I've had, we wouldn't be able to be sued because we would be protecting the public interest in terms of health.
Will there be other cases, though, where companies can sue the government under a free trade agreement?
Well, I can't rule that out because, I mean, there's a million permutations and combinations there. Someone can always take an action against the government, but, you know, whether they're successful, that's a completely different issue.
Thank you.
Mr. Scott has put out a press statement and pointed to some comments by Julia Gillard that she will exclude petrol from any ETS on the other side of the Tasman.
Right.
What's your reaction to that? Does it present any problems for coordinating the two countries?
I don't think so. I mean, look, at the end of the day, yeah, it's eminently possible that the scheme in Australia will be different in terms of its characteristics than New Zealand's. We'd need to see a final, you know, makeup of that that scheme before we can comment more fully. Look, it's possible they might have a different price, but in principle, New Zealand's largely been based on the CPRS model that was designed in Australia, has similar abatement rates, similar intensity profile. And, you know, if the Australians have taken petrol out, which, as I say, I've seen media reports as well, I mean, that's a matter for the Australians.
Speaking of the ETS, when is the government going to respond to the review?
It's getting closer. I don't know exactly when the response will be, but it'll certainly be, you know, well and truly before the election. So I'm not sure if the Minister's seen a final report. He's certainly given me a sort of general heads up of the direction it's taking, but I'm not sure if he's seen the final report yet.
Are you waiting to see what price the Australians?
Well, that's one factor to have a look at. I mean, the indications today seem to be that the price of carbon would be significantly higher in Australia than what's currently in operation in New Zealand, but you know, there may be some differences. We'll need to think that through. And they have a lot of different factors. I mean, for a start-off in Australia, of course, I mean, their big part of their market is not agriculture, it's actually coal-fired power plants, and that's the one that's like their consumers. And as you're probably aware, they've had big escalating energy prices anyway in Australia, so...
Isn't there a danger of waiting for Australia? Because the only announcements Gillard seems to be making is cancelling.
Well, we're not waiting for Australia. I mean, what we have in place is what I think is a moderate ETS. It's a first step. The next decision for the government is whether it continues on the program that we initiated when we passed the legislation, or whether we make some tweaks to that, which we would need to, you know, indicate before the election.
This morning you indicated some support for the Human Rights Commission.
I think the better way to characterise that would be to say, you know, we're aware that Judy McGregor's putting in this, we're drafting this legislation. We'd need to take a look at that. We haven't done that. Obviously, we haven't been shown the legislation yet. It's our belief that the law at the moment actually provides quite clearly that it's against the law to discriminate on the basis of gender under the Equal Pay Act in the 1970s and also the Human Rights Act. We also would have real concerns if it was divisive in the workplace or had unintended consequences. So I wouldn't say we'd support what the Human Rights Commission might put in, but we'll have a look at it.
The bill is already public and it's available on the website.
I haven't seen it yet. It wasn't this morning. Well, I didn't see it this morning.
And she put out a statement this morning saying that there would be no confidentiality issues around it.
Yeah, well, what one person thinks when they're drafting a bill and what's actually the case can be a vastly different proposition, as we know.
It doesn't require anyone to publish anyone's what people are being paid. It just, it's a right for an employee to ask an employee if they're being paid the same as the...
Yeah, but in a workplace where there's only two people working, by definition, that would open up an interesting situation.
So why do you think women are paid so much less than men?
Well, I don't know that if they are or they aren't. I don't have any data on that. Look, I don't want to speculate on that. There's a lot of reasons.
Do you think there's an issue of gender imbalance in terms of
pay? Well, I hope that there isn't. I mean, in my view, people should be paid the same irrelevant of gender. We're, as an employer at the moment, if you like, even though that's technically ministerial services, we select people on the basis of ability, irrelevant of gender, and they're paid the same.
So you'd agree with the intent of the bill in principle, but you don't see it?
Well, I think that should be reflected and is reflected in the law today. As I say, it's been the law for a very long period of time. That's against the law to discriminate on the basis of gender.
So you'd advise for the government to adopt it? She said that she'd really like the government to adopt the bill.
So. Well, what I'd say is we need to go away and have a look at that. And we haven't done that. We haven't had a chance to consider it. It's a complex issue. So we'll go away and get some advice on that.
I apologise if I've had advance for this question, but have you been following the Happy Feet improvement?
I have actually. I mean, it knocked me off the top of the bulletin on a couple of occasions, but I haven't taken it personally. No, Happy Feet didn't make it to the cabinet, but we wish him or her, I'm not quite sure its gender, a very speedy and happy recovery and a successful trip back to Antarctica. Thanks very much.